Good afternoon, everyone. This is Walter Fordham for Chronicles Radio. We're here today in Studio 2 in Halifax, Nova Scotia, talking to Jim Lowry, early student of Trungpa Rinpoche, in front of a live studio audience. And you're all of this generation, which is maybe, you know, we've been calling you the young people, ranging from, what, 18 to 25, something like that, all of you here. 26. You're the same age, basically, as many of us were when we first encountered Trungpa Rinpoche. But not to ramble on, welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Delighted to be here, see these beautiful young faces. Not to use the word young too loosely. Yep.
So, Jim, when did you first meet Trungpa Rinpoche?
Oh, we've started now. It was the dawning of the age of Aquarius. Jupiter was aligned with Mars. Peace was going to rule the planets and love would fill the sky. And there was a song of those words. And so there was a war in Vietnam. And there was a lot of dissatisfaction among America's youth. It was a time of financial prosperity and materialism run rampant and crazy. And a bunch of us college students started smoking pot and taking LSD and rebelling against our parents and against the system and against the Bank of America and getting out on the streets and saying, stop the war. And a lot of us got drafted and refused to go. And some people went to prison, Dennis Southward, and other people that we know went to prison. And I went to San Francisco.
Did you get drafted?
I did get drafted.
Really?
Yeah. Actually, I quit college first. I had a deferment at college. But when I dropped out of college, I got drafted. And I was scheduled to be inducted into the army and presumably go to Vietnam to war, but instead I went to Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, where you're supposed to be sure to wear flowers in your hair, which I forgot to do. But I did grow long, my hair long and beards, and started hanging out with other people doing this similar things mostly being pot and LSD, but also music and playing in the park and taking off our shirts. That was great when the girls did it. And dancing and going to rock and roll and Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones and the Janis Joplin. Lots of music. Santana. And a lot of live music and free music in the park. And Jim Morrison. And somehow out of this drugs and anti-war and down with the Bank of America and sort of angry at our parents for I'm not sure what, you know, for kind of raising us right, you know. But right became wrong because of, I don't know, materialism. So somewhere out of this, there a spiritual quest developed. And we started reading Alan Watts and Zen thingies, whatever we could find in English. Yogi Bhajan and Swami Satchidananda, different teachers would come to town, and I would go see them and maybe learned how to meditate a little bit. I mean, I'm not sure if we were actually meditating or not, but we were kind of doing something. We set up altars with maybe Buddhas or, you know, Hare Krishnas or
something. Lava lamps.
Lava lamps, right, you know. That's right. Or maybe some kind of Indian, you know, maybe some cochise with the turquoise necklaces or something. Some kind of spiritual quest. We're kind of trying to looking for some kind of reality beyond the material. And one thing leads to another in terms of we formed communes, groups of people, you know, alternative living styles, how to live without just working a regular job or without being greedy and sharing everything and living together. And through a series of accidents, a car breaking down in Boulder, some friends of mine were on their way to from San Francisco back to Connecticut, where they were from. Don Winchell, I'm not sure why, Herschel Franks, Michael McClellan, I'm not totally sure who these first group of people were, but their car broke down in Boulder, and they were having coffee in a coffee shop in Boulder, Colorado, and there was a little, like, free month's rent at farm, because they needed somebody to stay at this place to take care of this farm. So these guys moved in there. That became the Pygmy Farm. And they invited other people to come visit, and pretty soon there were about 20 of us living there. And we had this, it was sort of a communal thing. Everything belonged to everybody, and people showed up with cars, and the cars sort of belonged to everybody.
That was out the east baseline?
84, 90, something like that, east Arapaho.
Arapaho.
Yeah, so halfway to Longmont or something from Boulder.
Mm-hmm.
Way up on the hill with a beautiful view of the snow-capped Rocky Mountain Divide, Continental Divide of the Rockies. And we'd sit around in circles, and we'd pass the hash pipe, and we'd play drums and tambourines and do things like, oh, ma. And we'd get high, and our hair kept getting longer. You know. We made hash pipes out of deer antlers, and we made leather jackets out of deer skin. We would weave them together by hand with making these like leather jackets with the long fringe stuff hanging down, you know, like the Indian. We thought the Indians wore. I don't know. And we'd sell those at some local craft shops and buy beans and rice and dope.
Where did the name come from, Pygmy Farm?
Oh, Rick Kemp and his brother, Rick and Terry Kemp, were short compared to Michael McClellan. I think he called them pygmies. And so then it's like, this is a pygmy farm. We're going to grow pygmies, and we're going to grow up or something. I don't know. You know? And so that was kind of it. Some of the people were little. And then I think that it was actually the Blue Cloud Pygmy Farm.
Oh.
I think Blue Cloud was like the smoke, right? Clouds of blue offering smoke. Peace pipes. And so when people would come to town, we'd go visit them. You know, yogis and spiritual teachers would come, and we'd all pile in our vans and cars and head off to the venue at CU or wherever they gave talks in Boulder. And one time, I lived in a teepee. I had a teepee, and I had a little baby and a common-law wife, Jody and Ananda. And I lived in the teepee. Sometimes in the winter, we slept in the living room in the house. But it was a farmhouse. And Michael McClellan, somebody built a tree house. And there was a little pond in the back of the farm, had a little pond. And lots of beans and rice. And we had a garden, lots of zucchini. Beans, rice, and zucchini. It was a good diet. Very. If you don't like food, it was great. And one of the people that came to town, there was some Tibetan Lama was coming to town. They announced that we heard about it. A guy named Trigyun Trungpa Rinpoche, who I heard, I was reading a book called The 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, and somebody said, this guy is a lineage holder. He's descended from Milarepa. And I thought, well, that's cool. You know, he's probably wears some, like, little white cotton clothes and dances naked, half naked in the mountains and lives on, like, nettles, weeds or something, whatever Milarepa, you know. So I'm picturing this great yogi that can fly, and he puts his handprint in the rock and stuff. So who wouldn't want to go see him, right? So we go to Mackey Auditorium for this talk, and there's this little crippled, gimpy guy, kind of like, you know, like this, sitting in a chair, and he couldn't sit still because he was in obvious pain, actually. I think he'd been in a car wreck, and he kind of sit there, and he gave a talk, and I'm going to give an example of his talk, which is actually a different talk than this one. You want words of wisdom? You're here for words of wisdom? I have no words of wisdom. You really just want to be entertained, don't you? Well, go home. This path is dangerous and painful, and you shouldn't start it, and you shouldn't travel it. Just go home. You want entertainment? Go find it somewhere else. And that was so attractive. That was so magnetizing. Nobody would have thought of leaving. And the reason we dropped out of college and the reason we ran off and started doing drugs and free love and rock and roll and experimenting with just completely throwing away everything we had been taught was because, I think, we had been lied to all of our lives. Our parents lied to us. Our teachers lied to us in school. Our friends all lied to us. We lied to ourselves. And I'm not even putting down my parents. I don't think they intentionally lied to me. They described what they thought was the world, how to live in the world, how to be a person, you know, a good American boy. But it was lies. But I didn't know that. But I knew something was wrong. But when I heard this guy, I knew I'd heard the truth for the first time. And everything he did and every way he moved I said, I want to be like that. I want to be just like that. So, some bond was formed, you know, and the funny thing is, I mean, funny to me, strange, is that he thought we were terrific. He thought this bunch of long-haired hippie stone freaks were just wonderful people, you know. He really thought we were great, and we thought, you know, it was like, what's wrong with him, you know? Because we thought we were all fucked up. In fact, I asked him one time, one time later, a different time, when I spoke to him personally, I said, oh, Rinpoche, I'm so fucked up. And Rinpoche said, how do you know? What? How do you know? I still think about that. I mean, if I'm fucked up, how would I know if I was fucked up? Because then I'm fucked up, so I must be wrong. I could be wrong about being fucked up. But if I'm not fucked up, then I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't be fucked up. So, you know. So he didn't treat us like we were fucked up. And he came out to the Pygmy Farm for dinner one time, and we got to know each other. And we had interviews with him, individual interviews afterwards. Got to know him a bit. He taught us how to meditate, and we passed the pipe around when he was there at dinner, and he kind of was politely took it. I don't know if he actually smoked it or not, but he participated in the ritual after dinner with us. And but then he told us, maybe you should drink some wine with your dope. Just have a little wine, because marijuana is space. It's getting, you get high on space. But with alcohol, you get high on earth. And so maybe you should get a little more earth. Hmm. So we started having wine along with our with our marijuana.
How did you know he thought you guys, you were terrific? How did he exhibit that?
Oh, that's a good question. One time, this was about a year later or so, we'd been kicked out of the pygmy farm because a guy named Gaston.
Mudlike Costco.
No. Yeah, that's right.
What's his name? Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Anyway, some sort of famous hippie teacher came and parked his buses on the land, but we didn't know it, but the farmer that owned this farm where we were staying had a deal with the U.S. government. They would pay him for not farming. But he wasn't supposed to, you know, do things like have a bunch of bus caravans stay there. Anyway. So we got kicked. Anyway, we got kicked out of the pygmy farm, and we moved down to Mineral Hot Springs, Colorado, in San Jefferson Valley. Well, no, San Luis Valley. It's across the San Grande Cristos. And we were staying
about like 5 hours south of Boulder.
Something way south and west. Out in the desert, near the sand dunes. Colorado sand dunes are in this place. So we were staying in this hot springs with real hot water, a whole swimming pool full of hot water. We swam naked and had a good time. But we weren't allowed to smoke dope there. And so this became a little bit of an issue, but I mean, that may be why we got kicked out of there. But in any case, one time when we were staying there, I was with Jody and my daughter, Ananda, but we were kind of in this free love mode. So people would come and go, and some guy had showed up, and Jody was kind of flirting with this guy. And a bunch of us were due to go up to Boulder to have a meeting, a land meeting, we called them, with Rinpoche, because he wanted us to start a land center. To go back a little bit, Rinpoche had sent representatives out to the pygmy farm at some point to ask us if we would be the founders of a meditation center in the mountains of Colorado, and we had agreed to. In fact, they asked me, and I said, yes, we'll do it. And they said, don't you need to talk to everybody else? And I said, yeah, I do, but we'll do it. And so we agreed to do that, but we didn't have the land at the time, so we were just kind of crashing around. So we were in this place at Mineral Hot Springs waiting, and every now and then we'd have meetings with Rinpoche, and there would be 20 or 25 people meeting with Rinpoche in his living room in Four Mile Canyon in Boulder. But anyway, in this particular case, my girlfriend was flirting with this guy, and I was supposed to go off to this meeting, and I was going to spend the night in Boulder, so I just had this terrible, jealous, freaked out feeling that she was going to sleep with this guy while I was gone. But I still decided to go anyway because my guru wanted, you know, we're having this meeting. So I went. And so we sat around, we had this meeting, and we were drinking some wine, and we had these bottles of Mandavi, C.K. Mandavi or whatever they were, these gallons of wine. They had screw tops. Rinpoche would pick up this bottle of wine and pour himself a glass. You should try this. Try picking up a gallon of water or wine and pouring it without his hand, you know.
One hand.
With one hand and no shake, you know, no effort, just so smooth. And he smoked, and you remember his right hand. I mean, anybody that ever saw his right hand remembers his right hand, and he was just so elegant. And then there was this tremendous strength and elegance. Anyway, so we were at this meeting, and after the meeting kind of broke up, I don't know what we were talking about, what we were going to do when we got the land. I think we might put in an offer on some land, or we were looking for land. The room sort of cleared out. For some reason, everybody needed to go pee or something, and just Rinpoche and I were sitting in this room. I was sitting, and he was sitting in a chair. I was sitting on the floor across from him, and he said, "How are you?" And I said, Oh, Rinpoche, Jody's going to fuck this guy tonight. Oh, my God. I'm just freaked. I'm totally freaked out. You know, I'm just totally freaked out. And he said, come here. And I walked over and sort of got up next to him, and he put his arms around me. And he held me, and he started crying.
Oh, my God.
And he was crying. He was holding me. And I was crying. And he said, you have no territory to defend. And I said, what? He said, you have no territory to defend. He said, you could just put yourself at her mercy. And my mind just stopped. And I looked at him. And I had a moment of no territory to defend. A moment of enlightenment, you know. And everything was fine for about 5 minutes.
That's wonderful.
And then the people came back into the room. But it was those moments of just personally caring, of actual physical touching and just personal. It was just personal that he cared about us. And when he asked us to found the Rocky Mountain Dharma Center, Rocky Mountain, I don't remember what it was called, Karmazong in the Mountains or something. When he asked us to do this, it was like, because you are the people that could establish a meditation center that could last for generations. And, you know, it was like, you know, we could.
This is the sense that he really trusted you to do something.
Yeah. And way more than we trusted ourselves. Way more than we trusted ourselves. So I'm not sure exactly how he communicated that but there were those moments each individual must have had. And then as a group, he did. He seemed to think we could start this meditation center and that it might last and be meaningful.
So you all did move there.
Jonathan Eric inherited some money. Right. And he took that money, and we had looked at some land. John Baker and I, by the way, one more thing about the Rinpoche liking us, which I only found out recently. Steve Baker is the guy that drove Rinpoche in an old beat-up Datsun to the pygmy farm when Rinpoche came for dinner that time. And I just saw him recently and said, remember that? I said, remember what Rinpoche said? They're too good to be true. Did that mean we weren't true? Here it is, what, 40 years later, I'm still questioning whether Rinpoche really liked us or not. You know, I still can't believe it. And Steve said, oh, no, he meant you were really... Rinpoche said to me on the way back from dinner, if I were born in the West, I'd want to be one of them.
Wow.
That's what Steve told me, Rinpoche said. This was years later, but it does confirm that he really did like us for some reason.
I actually have Steve on... tape.
Oh, good.
Talking about that drive.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we should patch that into this conversation. Okay, let's listen to this recording from Steve.
Around that time, my recollection of this is that, and I'm not sure how much I remember or how much I was there. There was a delegation that came from the Pygmies. They'd heard about Trungpa Rinpoche, and I think it was Zanto, Terry Mason. And it might have been Jim Lowry, whose name I've forgotten. And they came in to Rinpoche's bedroom. He was doing interviews at the time. And they sat at the end of the bed. Actually, they sat against the wall. And I remember one of them, I think it was Zanto, saying, we're bodhisattvas. And he was so welcoming and accommodating to them. And they were, you know. So they invited him to come out to the farm. And they lived in a house which I could never find. But I know it was around 85th and Arapaho. And at the time, somebody, I forgot who, had maybe Carl, had given him a little yellow Carmen Ghia. and that was his transportation at the time. The night he went to the pygmy farm, I drove him out there in the little Carmangia. And I don't have a lot of memory at that time, but I'm sure if you talk to the other guys, they will. My memory is that we went out there, we sat around, they made vegetarian food, they served things like tahini with rice and vegetables, and that and everybody got stoned afterwards, and they sat around drumming. And he just sat there sort of bouncing around listening to the drumming, and I was totally freaked out, because that scene was, it was as much of a hippie as I was, that it just freaked me out. Something about it, like they were just wild. And on the way home, he said, if I had been born in another life, I think I would have been one of them. I would have been born in that situation. And I was horrified, because to me, I felt very uptight there. And he seemed to love it.
And now back to Jim.
So Jonathan Eric inherited some money and put a down payment on a piece of land. And at that point, the Pygmies were living in tents up in, I guess, the Rocky Mountain National Park or somewhere, but just somewhere up in National Forest up outside of Boulder in the mountains. And a snowstorm came and buried our tents, collapsed them. Terry Kemp, who was called Emer at the time, didn't show up. We woke up in the morning, we all went out and built the fire and, made some coffee or whatever, and Emer was missing. It's like, where is Emer? We looked around. His tent was over there, and it wasn't even there. There's nothing but snow. So we went over, and poking around in the snow, and there's a lump, We thought, oh my God, So we kind of moving the snow. It must have been a foot and a half or so of snow over just overnight. Anyway, you hear this thing unzip, and then his head comes popping out. He looks around. Anybody have a cigarette? So we all went down to Rinpoche's house, and he crashed in his living room, and with Lady Diana was not too happy about that. And so the next day we were kind of ushered off to go up to this land that had just been closed on, just been purchased, up northwest of Fort Collins. And so we showed up in our trucks and our vans and our cars, and we pulled up at the top of the hill, and we looked out over this expanse of white snow 2 feet deep as far as we could see. We weren't even sure where the property line was. And we rolled snowballs to kind of clear some land and put up a tarp and spent the first night there. And then some cowboys came and tried to chase us off the next day and a few other adventures, but we stayed. And the neighbors accepted us eventually as... Once we survived the winter, that was fine with them. If you can get through the winter in the Rockies, you're okay. Uh-huh. You're like us,
So, this is the land that is now known as...
The land that's now known as Shambhala Mountain Center. Right. At the time, it was known as The Land. But it wasn't a catchy enough name, so we changed it.
You are listening to Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Please tune in next week for part two of my conversation with Jim Lowry. In this next episode, Jim talks about how Rinpoche got the Pygmies to stop smoking dope. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listening audience. To contribute, visit chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for your support, and thank you for listening to Chronicles Radio.